and now protecting the historic artifacts of nations worldwide. In England, lawmakers have gone so far as to pass a law aimed at curbing the looting of historic sites while guaranteeing that those who find treasure are compensated. Joining me now is Roger Bland to talk about the UK's Treasure Act and Portable Antiquities Scheme. Roger Bland is head of the Department of Portable Antiquities and Treasures for the United Kingdom. He speaks at the Kansas City, Missouri Public Library tonight. And Roger, nice to have you.
Thank you very much.
Good morning.
Glad to be here.
Now, Great Britain has this law called the Treasure Act, which puts a new twist on the old phrase, finders, keepers, losers, weepers. What's the point of this law, Roger?
Okay, well, England and Wales were really unusual in that they'd never actually passed a law about objects, discovered antiquities, objects that members of the public find in the ground. And it took a long time to get any reform through Parliament, and it took a few disaster cases as well. But eventually that did happen in 1996. And the law that we've got has been really working pretty well. We've it basically says that anything that is at least an object that's at least 300 years old and made of gold or silver, or any group of coins from the same find, again, they have to be 300 years old, qualify as treasure. And if you find it, you're supposed to report it. And we've got a network of archaeologists around the country called Finds Liaison Officers to whom people can report those finds. And then they look at it, decide whether it does qualify as treasure or not. And it goes, and actually the coroner still has a role in this, which is rather strange, but it's an archaic English system. And he has to declare the find to be treasure, and then it's offered to a museum to buy. And there's an independent committee called the Treasure Valuation Committee that decides what the full market value is of the find, and that's divided equally between the guy who makes the find and the owner of the land where the find's made.
Now, do people actually report the stuff they find? I can just imagine some treasure hunters or metal detectorists out there who comes across a very valuable coin. I'm not sure their first impulse is to go and report it to the authorities.
Well, probably it wasn't always so, but we've really worked hard over the last 15 years with all the people who use metal detectors. And I mean, they're certainly well aware of the law nowadays. And I think,
and
the
you
figures,
think they comply with it?
Well, the figures speak for themselves. I mean, under the old law, we were getting about 25 finds a year being reported. Last year, in 2011, we had 970 cases. So that's quite an increase, I think.
That's amazing to me. Are you happy with that?
We're very happy with it. I mean, the problems that we have are to do with the amount of material that's coming in, and mm-hmm. that is actually presents challenges of its own, just dealing with the sheer quantity of objects that come in. So, you know, it presents a big challenge for our staff to have a time to evaluate them all and study them all, and also to museums who want to buy them. And I should sort of say, too, that it's not only the gold and silver objects and the hoards of coins we're interested in. It's actually anything archaeological, but it's a purely voluntary matter to report anything other than those gold and silver objects. But so, last year we saw 100,000 objects altogether.
Oh, that's amazing.
That is a lot.
Yeah, it's a lot. So what was happening in England prior to this law that necessitated, in your view, this law to be passed to begin with, Roger?
Well, we didn't have a law as such. What we had was a common law, which actually you have over this side of the water as well, I believe. And it was part of the feudal rights of the Crown to own treasure that people dug up. And this had got adapted in a rather curious way to be used as a law to protect antiquities. And since about 1886, the state had been paying rewards for finds of treasure trove. But the old definition said that the objects had to be made of gold or silver and to have been buried with the intention of recovery. And we used to get into endless discussions and arguments about why objects had been buried in the ground, which was just had nothing whatsoever to do with really whether these finds were important or not.
Yeah. Well, so is there all kinds of gold and silver buried on the shores of England, even to this day?
The more time I spend working in this area, the more I just realize the sheer enormous quantities of objects that there are to be found still, you know, under the soil.
And do I need to get on an airplane and come over and start paying for my kids' college educations by digging up some good stuff?
We're not keen on we don't really see it as a way of getting rich quick.
But it can be.
It can be, but I think it's a mug's game, actually. The people who the people who spend most time detecting in England say you've got a better chance of winning the lottery than getting rich quick with a metal detector, because the great majority of the objects that people do dig up are not worth very much at all. But they are of huge interest from an archaeological point of view, and they can tell us so much about the past.
So the new law sort of removes at least some of the temptation to not report, right? The inclination now is to report because there's a built-in system to reward me for finding something valuable.
That's the key part of it. Yeah, I think that I think people do appreciate in England that if they do the right thing and report their finds, and you know the law says they should, that they will be fairly treated and they will get adequate compensation. And I think I think we can say that that must be working because of the sheer increase in the number of cases that people are reporting. I mean, I'm not saying everything gets reported, but a great deal does.
Let's talk about some of these cases. And again, if you're just joining us this morning, we're talking to Roger Bland about the UK's Treasure Act. What happens when people find something valuable in England? What's the system in place to take care of this? And by all means, if you want to join our conversation, 816-235-2888, our email address, UpToDate@kcur.org, or go to KCUR's Facebook page. And I should point out that Roger will be speaking this evening at 6:30 at the Kansas City, Missouri Public Library, the branch on the Country Club Plaza. For more information on how to RSVP, go to kclibrary.org. Well, let's talk about one of these cases, Roger, because it's so interesting to me. I came across this example of the effect of this law with the case of Martin Sulzbacher, if I'm saying that right. A Jew who fled Nazi Germany in 1938. Tell us about what happened in this case.
Oh, that's just an amazing story.
It's an absolutely amazing story.
Well, about in 2007, some people who lived in a sheltered housing, a block of flats, were digging a new pond in the garden. And they came across this jar. It had 80 U.S. gold double eagle coins. From the late 19th century. The latest one was 1913, I think. And this was a really unusual find. We never had anything like this from the United Kingdom before. And our first thought was, well, you know, the latest coin is less than 100 years old. It's possible that we might find not the person who buried it, that was going to be very unlikely, but at least descendants or people who might know about who might have buried that. And we spent a long time trying to research the history of the house where the jar of coins was found, but without any success because it had been destroyed in the Second World War.
How much value are we talking about here, these 80 double eagle coins?
Well, a fair amount. I think they eventually sold at auction for about 80,000 Great British pounds. So that's what, about $130,000.
Okay.
So it's a fair amount of money, but you weren't going to be able to retire on it, put it that way.
So you couldn't find, you looked to see who had occupied the house during the war, you're saying?
And we just, there'd been so many different people living in the house over the last 50 years because it was apartment blocks and a lot of people had come and gone that we didn't get anywhere. So what we did was we asked the coroner to open the inquest on the hoard and say, these coins have been found. If anyone has a claim, they've got 6 months to come forward and make their claim. And we didn't say we didn't give the address of where the coins have been found so that we weren't going to advertise that. And eventually what came out of that was the local historian who was interested in the history of the area. It was in a suburb of London where the jar of coins was found, told us about a press cutting of a report in 1952 when another jar of coins, exactly the same sort of coins, American gold double eagles, had been found and claimed, what was very interesting, claimed by the owner. And the owner turned out to be a German Jewish banker who'd fled to England just before World War II. fleeing persecution, obviously, from the Nazis, and had come over to England with all his family and bought this house in this suburb of London called Hackney. And when the war came, he was actually interned as an enemy alien, rather like a lot of Japanese people of Japanese origin were interned in California, I think, after Pearl Harbor. Mm-hmm. And he was sent, first of all, to Canada on a ship to internment, and that ship was torpedoed. But he survived, came back to England, and they sent him off on another ship to Australia. And he survived that trip as well, and eventually got home and found that his house, had, where all the members of his family were living, had been completely destroyed by a German bomb in the Blitz on London. Tragically, all five members of his family who were living there had been killed. Mm. And it turned out that his brother, who was still in the house, had buried all his coins in the garden for safekeeping. They'd originally been in a safe deposit box in a bank in the City of London, but his brother reckoned that would be the first place that the Nazis would come looking if they invaded England. So he took them out and buried them in the garden. But sadly,
but he was killed in the Blitz, yeah.
And Martin Sulzbacher tried to look for them, but the site was was literally a bomb site. It was covered with debris everywhere, I think. And one jar of coins was found 7 years later when they rebuilt the house. But obviously there was another jar that they didn't recover then. And all this wonderful press story from 1952 meant we were able to know the name of the person who buried the coins. And then we were actually able to track down his son, who had been living in England most of his life, but he'd recently retired to Jerusalem. And he came over and he claimed the coins. And the great that he donated the jar and one of the coins to the local museum. He did sell the rest at auction, but he was completely free to do that. And he said he was going to use the money to restore the graves of all his relations who'd been killed during the bombing in the Blitz.
Oh, that's such a great story. And these coins were just found, were they wrapped in anything or just stuck in a jar?
They were wrapped in paper, actually, and then stuck in a jar. And obviously they were what Mr. Sulzbacher, who was a Jewish banker, had been able to smuggle out from Germany. When he fled, I think it was in 1936, fleeing Nazi persecution. It's an amazing story, isn't it?
There was also this astonishing find of more than 52,000 Roman coins in 2010 that were unearthed by a metal detectorist, David Crisp, in England. The coins were 1,700 years old, a little more down the lines of what this act is supposed to deal with. They were discovered buried in a tightly packed pot. You ended up writing a book about this find, Roger. What happened in this case?
Well, that's a great story, actually, because the metal detector user who found it, Mr. Chris, did everything absolutely right. And he got this signal with his machine, and he dug down, and he found the top of a pot, and then he dug a bit further, and he realized that this pot was absolutely full of coins. Now, what most people would do in that situation
would be to keep digging.
Yeah.
I would have.
But he didn't.
In a hurry, too.
He didn't. And that was so important, because actually what he did was he reported it to our local finds liaison officer, who was able to organize an archaeological dig. And that dig revealed this pot. It's about 1 foot high, and it's about 18 inches wide. Mm-hmm. It was not enormous, but it was absolutely packed full of coins. And when we got all the coins back to the British Museum and weighed them, they came to 160 kilograms. That's more than two people weigh. It was an incredible weight of coins. But because the archaeologists were able to dig it out, they removed it very carefully, layer by layer. And that gave us a whole lot of information about how that hoard was buried, which we just wouldn't otherwise have had. And that's actually led us to ask why hoards like this were buried. Set of questions. It's not a unique hoard. It's the biggest hoard of its type. But we know of about nearly 600 other hoards of coins from the same period. And we'd always assumed that people were burying them at the time because they were worried about foreign invasion. We know that there were a lot of attacks on the Roman Empire at the time. We're talking about 300 AD. Mm-hmm. And there's plenty of evidence, at least over the water in France, that there were lots of attacks. But in Britain, not so much. And actually, we do wonder whether maybe this hoard was not buried because by somebody who was afraid that they were going to, they needed somewhere safe to put their wealth because they were afraid they were about to be attacked by a Saxon raider. But maybe they buried it deliberately as an offering to the gods.
What kind of return, what did the man, David Crisp, who found these coins, what did he get as his portion or his reward for this?
Okay, well, Mr. Sulzbacher's find wasn't a typical treasure find because we did actually, very unusually, we found the heir of the owner. And so that went back to him. His claim, you know, was stronger than the claim of the state to own that hoard. So, but most hoards, like the big hoard of coins from Frome in Somerset, that went through the normal process under the Treasure Act, and it was valued by this committee at over £300,000. It's about not far off $500,000.
Wow.
That reward then was paid equally to Dave Crisp, the guy with the metal detector who found it, and the farmer on whose land it was found.
So in three equal parts, you're saying?
In two parts.
Two parts.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So, and now it's being bought by the local museum, and they've got a selection of objects. They've just redone the museum in Somerset, and it's one of their star exhibits.
How can the museum afford something like this, given the price tag you just mentioned?
Well, we're lucky in England because grant bodies that you can go to who will help museums acquire finds, but they're very interested in supporting new finds that they think the public are interested in. And so the key to this one, raising the money for this, was to actually make sure that the find had good publicity, because that made the grant-giving bodies and also general members of the public, we had a public appeal. And I remember, I think I gave about 15 talks about the hoard over that six-month period when they were raising the money. And we, for example, filled the biggest lecture theatre at the British Museum when I gave a talk on it. There was a lot of public interest in it, and that means actually people are quite happy, you know, to give money to the hoard. We had another.
I love the name you have for this, the hoard. That sounds
right.
That would draw a lot of attention just by itself. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
We had another bigger one found the year before, an enormous Anglo-Saxon trove called the Staffordshire Hoard, which has actually recently been on show over in this country in Washington, D.C. with National Geographic. And that was valued at some $5 million. And lots of people said that you'll never get the money, you'll never be able to raise the money for that. And in fact, they raised it in record time because the public were just queuing up to give money to it, actually. Such was the interest in it.
Well, is England the only country to have a law like this, or what do other countries do, Roger?
It is pretty much unique, actually. Most in the rest of Europe, the majority of countries have much stricter rules about the use of metal detectors.
In France, particularly, right?
It is. Yeah. That's right. Yes, there are a few other countries in Northern Europe. They tend to be a bit closer to England, but I think we, like you, actually have this quite strong libertarian instinct, and I don't think there would ever have been any support for introducing strict controls on the use of metal detectors. And you only need to look at countries where they do have very strict controls to see that actually it's very difficult ever to enforce, because you're never going to be able to have the law enforcement agencies out supervising every field where people might go detecting. So our whole ethos is really to try and work with these people and to actually to make them feel that they're not criminals, but they can contribute to our heritage.
What does this country do? You know, if I go out in a field and I find 52,000 Roman coins dating back hundreds and hundreds of years, what happens then?
Well, actually, as I understand it, it's quite complicated. I think because each state has different laws governing it, and I think that in some areas there's it's still French law, and in some of the states in the south, and then I think some countries have the old English law of treasure trove. In some states, there's the old English law of treasure trove. So I think it's quite a complicated picture, but I'm not really the expert.
Well, Darren Summers, the treasurer for the Midwestern Artifact Society Metal Detecting Club, will join us in just a few minutes, and we'll ask him what right. that's all about. This other story really intrigued me as well. May 2010, Roger, an extraordinary Roman ceremonial helmet was found in your country
right.
using a metal detector.
Right.
An unemployed man in his 20s found it. Tell us about the helmet and what happened in this
case. Okay, well, that's a find which didn't have such a happy outcome, I've got to say. It was an amazing discovery of a Roman helmet worn by a cavalryman.
Ceremonial helmet, basically.
Yeah, it wouldn't have been used in war.
It's a
really spectacular object, and it was probably used for parades and so on. And he did report it to us. It wasn't covered by our law because it was a single object, and it wasn't made of gold or silver. He did report the find to us, and we do know exactly where it was found, which is really important because there were a lot of stories circulating on the internet later that it didn't really come from the north of England, but from maybe from Eastern Europe. But we know for sure where it came from.
Mm-hmm.
But sadly, he didn't have a legal obligation to offer it to a museum, and he decided, he and the farmer where it was found decided to sell it at auction. And the auction house, big auction house, Christie's, sold it. The estimate was, I think, £200,000, what, $300,000.
Mm-hmm.
It actually sold for $2 million, $3 million.
Oh, yeah.
The museum in the area was really anxious to try and buy it, and they came $300,000 of raising the money for it.
$300,000?
Yeah, but they just missed it. And it was bought by a private individual back at October 2010, and we haven't seen it since.
Oh, what a shame.
It is a shame, because there was such strong local interest in it in the area. People would have loved to have seen it.
Can you ask this gentleman or woman, whoever bought it, can you say, hey, can you bring it over here for a few months, let us see it?
Well, we've tried that, but we don't know who it is. So
you don't know who it is at all?
No, we don't know who bought it. I mean, we passed a message back through Christie's, and I'm sure they passed it on to the buyer, but we haven't had anything since.
But in this case, the unemployed man in his 20s who found it, he was compensated to some extent, wasn't he?
He will have split the price it fetched at auction with the farmer on whose land it was found. So he did quite well out of it.
He came out of it pretty well. So would you advocate a similar law for this country, Roger?
I wouldn't advocate it for every country, but I think I think conditions in the States are really quite similar to how they are in England. I think, you know, I think there's quite a big hobby of metal detecting over here. And I think that I've met quite a few metal detector users from the United States. And I've always been impressed by the fact that they're actually, although I know that there's quite a lot of archaeologists who are quite critical of the way they behave, but the people I've met have always been actually people who want to do the right thing. They've been very solid, respectable, responsible people. But I think the system, the setup over here, doesn't really give them an opportunity, or it makes it quite difficult for them to behave in a responsible way, because what we've been able to offer in England, and I don't think it's available here in the same way, is a route for them to do the right thing, people to whom they can report their finds.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure over here there probably are some archaeologists who'll be happy to work with them, but it's not going to be part of their job. And, you know, I'm sure lots of archaeologists will have all sorts of other things on their plate to do, and probably spending a lot of time recording the finds made by the detector users is probably not their top priority. And that's what we found is the key thing, is having that group of archaeologists who have just that job and no other job.
Well, interesting story. Roger, thanks for sharing it with us today.
Pleasure.
That's Roger Bland. He's head of the Department of Portable Antiquities and Treasures for the UK. Again, he speaks this evening at 6:30 at the Kansas City, Missouri Public Library, the branch on the plaza. For more information on how to RSVP, go to kclibrary.org. Coming up in our second half today, we'll talk with a metal detectorist about the situation here in the Kansas City area and what they're finding these days. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. And welcome back. I'm Steve Kraske. If you missed Friday's live broadcast from opening day at the K, you'll find that and all of our older broadcasts at kcur.org. Tomorrow on the program, looking beyond the Supreme Court decision on health care reform. Now joining us is one of those metal detectorists who always has the potential to turn up treasure whenever they don their headphones and set out on another hunt. With us now is Darren Summers. He's a treasurer for the Mid-America Artifact Society Metal Detecting Club. And, Darren, good morning.
Good morning.
Nice to have you.
Nice to be here.
How is the metal detecting world these days?
Well, good. Yeah.
Is it?
We enjoy the hobby. Got a lot of area clubs. There's actually three in Kansas City area.
Really?
Yeah.
How many members altogether?
Altogether, I don't know for the other clubs. Several of our members are members of all three. For our club, we number in the 50s.
Yeah.
About 50 members.
Are you the largest?
I think we are for this area.
Yeah.
Topeka also has a club, so there are clubs out there and around.
And the point of the club is what?
Just get people together to share their finds, be able to go out and hunt together, have a detecting partner, find new locations, that sort of thing.
Now, what's the most valuable thing that you've ever found?
Me? Now,
yes.
You're asking the total wrong person, because anything I've ever found has never been
really
valuable.
You've shot lights here? Really?
Yeah. So, you know... my most valuable find's probably in the $10 or $20 range. You know, I've
like,
never.
What was
anything.
That?
Various coins, little things like that. You know.
So you haven't hit the jackpot yet.
No, but that's not really the reason for getting into metal detecting. If you're getting into it for the sole goal of making money and of that nature, you're getting into the wrong thing.
Isn't that why people do it though?
No, I don't know anybody in our club who sells anything they find. I don't know anybody that does that. They get into it because it's the thrill of finding something. It's the thrill of discovering the history of the object. That's what really drives them. It's not so much a monetary type thing.
Where are great places to go metal detecting? I'm always thinking of places where I see them, which is like Loose Park. You know, but are there other neat places, maybe potentially more lucrative places to go than Loose Park?
Sure. Parks are probably where most people get started detecting,
Obviously,
you know, public property, and that's where they kind of go out. It's not the greatest place perhaps to learn a detector when you first pick one up, just because parks tend to be very trashy environments. You know, you would be amazed at how much metal is laying across the ground in a park.
Like you're pulling up pull tabs from pop cans.
Yeah. And those items will mask the good targets that you're looking for too. And it when you're assaulted with a lot of noise as you swing a detector, it's hard to learn what the detector is trying to tell you.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the better places, of course, would be where people have not hunted before. So a lot of that would be private property.
Where people have not hunted before?
Sure. You know, because if you haven't had a metal detector on the property before, there's probably more stuff to find. No one's been there, remove stuff. So
you say hunted, you mean metal detected.
I'm
tracking.
Of course.
Yeah.
So you want to – a lot of people will knock on doors and just ask for permission to hunt at a property, a house, a thing of that nature, you know. And that's where you'll find some interesting items too.
So the goal of most of your fellow club members then is to just go out and it's a hobby.
It's a hobby,
mm-hmm.
Absolutely, and it's a great hobby. You know, it's one that gives you a chance to really kind of explore history. You never know what you're going to find. It leads you in interesting directions that you didn't necessarily go down. You learn a lot of local history. If you get serious about finding new places to hunt, you know, better places to go out and detect. So that's really kind of the goal.
If you knock on someone's door with the aim of trying to go to a new place and find something new and different, do they typically sort of seize on that moment, the homeowner, the property owner, to say, well, hey, sure, but if you find something, Buster, you want to share it with me, right?
Sometimes that happens. A lot of times they are just more interested in seeing what you might find.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and some people aren't interested in having you detect on their property at all. You know, I mean, it just depends, you know.
Those are the people where the bodies are buried. You got to watch out for those folks, right?
Yeah, I don't know about that.
Yeah.
But, yeah, so, I mean, some people would be like, you know, I'll show you anything I find if there's something that you want. Or other people would be like, you know, a number of years ago, I lost a ring in my yard. I kind of know where I lost it. You know, I know the area I was planting the garden, but I was never able to find it. Maybe you could help me look for it, you know, and if you find it, I would like to have it back. And we do get a number of calls from people around the area who ask to help us find things like a lost ring and of that nature. And we've got people that will go out and volunteer to kind of help people out.
So. Do you volunteer in those cases, or do you charge a fee?
Most of our members, the people that want to do that, will assist. They would like to be able to, you know, if it's on a nice piece of property, they'd like to be able to continue to hunt on it, you know, and find, you know, keep whatever else they might find. Some people, if it's a long distance from where they're going to be, might say, you know, that would kind of like to be reimbursed for my gas money, you know, to get there. But yeah. As a general rule, most of them don't. Not to say that some don't.
So Darren, you're hunting in this one person's house. She says she lost her ring in the garden, and you're detecting and you find it. So what are you hearing in your headphones that suggests to you that something very significant might be not far away?
Okay. Well, it's totally different from what you see in the movies, because almost every movie I've ever seen that has a metal detector in it has it wrong. They make it sound like a Geiger counter.
Yeah, almost, right.
You know,
right.
Like,
that's exactly what
like
I was thinking.
I'm approaching something, I'm getting warmer,
sure.
Warmer, and that's not the way it works.
Okay.
You get a single beep when you go over the object.
A single beep?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
It's not exciting. You're not, like,
no, you generally are pretty quiet. If
not a band playing a theme song in the background here, no, just a little beep.
Right. If there's no metal in the ground that you're swinging your detector over, you don't hear anything. That should be the way it should be, you know, in a perfect world. And then when you sweep over the object, you'll get a beep. Now,
can you tell from the beep if it's something tiny or something big, or is it just a beep?
I can tell that generally when I go to pinpoint the object. On most detectors, you'll squeeze a trigger, and you'll bring that puts it in all metal mode, and you'll swing in on the object, and it gets louder as you center your coil over it. And generally, you can tell if the object, let's say I have a depth meter on the detector, and it indicates it's probably 5 or 6 inches down.
You have a depth meter on that thing?
Oh, yeah.
So you can tell right away what you're looking at.
Yeah, it's an estimate of what the depth is.
Is it accurate?
For the most part, when you buy a detector, it comes with a standard size coil, and the display meter is calibrated for that coil. When you switch to a different coil, a smaller coil or a larger coil, it throws off that depth meter.
Mm. Why would you switch coils?
If I was in a really trashy area, I'd want to use a smaller coil to better separate out the objects that I'm looking for.
Oh.
You know, a piece of trash, as I say, can mask a good target. It'll average the signals. If I'm using a small coil, then I just get a better chance of my detector being right over that individual object I'm looking for, better separated out from the trashy objects.
Yeah.
A larger coil will allow me to go to greater depth, but I will lose smaller objects. So if I was looking for something larger, say the size of a can or a jar, I might use a larger coil in order to try to find that and have a better depth.
We're talking about metal detecting here on Up to Date. If you are a metal detector and want to tell us what you found in the Kansas City area, give us a shout, 816-235-2888, our email address, updatedate@kcur.org, or go to KCUR's Facebook page. So in the Kansas City area, are there some hunters who have really found some incredible things? Are you aware of some great stories from the Kansas City area here?
We've got members that do all types of detecting. We have a lot that you would call, they call them coin shooters. That's their main focus, is looking for our older coins.
Coin shooters?
Yeah,
that
sort of thing.
Yeah.
You've got others that are more interested in relics, and they'll research Civil War kind of areas or where campsites might have been and focus on those type of items. But yeah, there's been some interesting items found. I don't know anything you would call some great historical value, you know, unless you get away from just metal detectors and consider, you know, like the Steamboat Arabia. That was not made by archaeologists. That was made by four people that went looking for it, you know, as being a great find. But there have been numbers of items. I've seen members come in with about the size of your palm, a very ornate silver piece that was traded to the Indians for furs, that sort of thing. There's actual pictures of Indians, like an Indian chief wearing multiple of those on his clothing, old pictures like that.
Wow. But no one's gotten rich.
Oh, no. And like I said, I don't know anybody that actually sells anything they find.
Yeah.
You know? We have in the past partnered with different archaeologists in the area as well. If you're talking down in Olathe, they have a or they have a Lone Elm Park down there, mm-hmm. which is a 160-acre community park that was dedicated on June 9th in 2005. And they purchased that land in 2000. Well, it's the site that was used for 4 decades, beginning in 1821, as a campground and a rendezvous point for travelers along the Santa Fe, Oregon, California trails.
You're kidding.
So they knew they were going to be doing a lot of dirt work out in that area and moving mm-hmm. a lot of things, doing a lot of construction, building ball fields, and we're kind of concerned about losing some of that artifacts. And so we had volunteered to go down on numerous occasions, and we went out with archaeologists. We would find an object, we would mark it, write down what we thought the depth was for the mm-hmm. target, and the archaeologist would come and had a large GPS backpack, you know, very precise, and mark what the spot was, and then they dig it up and recover it and bag it and write and tag it, and then they did a nice plot map showing where everything was found. So that was kind of interesting.
So that worked out pretty well then.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and in fact, if you go down to that park, there's a shelter house built down there, and it lists the community partners and people that helped make that park what it is, and Midwestern Artifact Society is listed on that plaque.
Well, what do you make of our guests in our first half today about this Treasure Act, as Roger talked about it, for the law that's in place in England designed to compensate those who find it, but also to give museums a chance to get these treasures before they're taken away somewhere. Good idea or not? Would that be a good law for this country?
I think it's a great idea for this country. Mm-hmm. You know, he alluded to the fact that there's a lot of different laws depending on where you are. It varies from city to city where you can even detect in the parks.
Is that
or not.
True? Is he right about that?
Oh, yeah. And it's really hard to know where it is okay to go detecting and where it isn't. Obviously, national parks, battlefield sites, things like that are completely off limits. You don't touch anything like that. But, you know, people wonder about, is it okay in my local park if I go detecting? You know, well, there's different city ordinances. There's different state rules. There's, you know, and I think a law such as they have serves everybody. I think the metal detectorist benefit because a landowner, where they're compensated for something, if it's something valuable is found on their land and the museum purchases it, is compensated. It offers up them a reason to say, sure, come on out. We welcome you to come out and detect on our land. It helps protect the hobby for those that are interested in metal detecting, and the museums tend to benefit, and the public does as well from the discovery of new sites and new objects.
Let's grab some phone calls here. Jason from Kansas City, Missouri. Good morning. You're on with Darren Summers. Nice to have you.
Hey, thanks. Yeah, the other day I was using a metal detector at work trying to find some buried copper wires, and all of a sudden I was getting a bunch of trash, and all of a sudden it beeped that I had found coins, which usually means silver, so I dug a little bit, and sure enough, I found a ring that had been made out of an Australian coin in the 1940s, and it fit, and since I'd lost my wedding ring in my house a couple months ago, that's my wedding ring now. You never know what you're going to find.
Not a bad way to go, Jason. Yeah.
Yeah.
Congratulations, and thanks for the call.
Absolutely.
You bet. Well, what's it cost, Darren, to get hooked up with a good metal detecting outfit?
Okay, for someone that's just getting into it and isn't sure if it's a hobby that they're interested in, I would say around the $200 range. There's some really nice detectors out there.
What does yours cost, can I ask?
Mine originally, when I bought it, retailed around 900 and some.
Oh, so I
paid about 700 and some for it.
You're upscale.
Yeah, so most people don't end up paying the full retail price that's listed on the detectors. If they go to a true detector store, mm-hmm. you can find deals on them. And during the holidays at Christmas time, they generally offer big bundles from the manufacturer that includes like a pouch and a digger and headphones and things of that nature mm-hmm. at a discounted price. But a good detector for someone that was getting started is like a Garrett Ace 250, and it runs right around $210, $212. Somewhere around that range. Yeah. And that's a good detector to let someone know if they're interested.
Michael from Leavenworth. Michael, go quickly if you would.
Yeah, I just got a tip for all you treasure hunters out there. I'm an old treasure hunter myself. Been doing it over 50 years. And I use a metal detector once in a while, but not very often. However, the best place to find anything is in the old toilets. And there, you can look them up at the courthouse. Especially here in Leavenworth, there's a whole row of them behind all the factories that used to be here. They bulldozed them up here. And I have found everything from Indian artifacts clear to pioneer days from the Civil War. You name it, I found it. I found glass doorknobs in the cast.
Wow.
At the kilns.
Does that make sense to you, Darren?
Yeah. What he's talking about is known as privy digging.
Yeah.
And we do have one member who focuses on that. He likes going to old ghost towns in Kansas,
yeah,
locating where the privies were. And a lot of people threw, like, the old bottles down into the privy when they were through them. You didn't have trash coming and taking it away from your house. And so he likes finding drugstores from these towns that don't exist that might have had a bottle that's never been seen before and tries to work that into a book.
Well, someone else can do the privy digging on my behalf, I think. Darren, so good to have you. Thanks for taking some time.
Thank you.
That's Darren Summers. He's treasurer for the Midwestern Artifact Society Metal Detecting Club. Tomorrow on the program, looking beyond the U.S. Supreme Court decision on health care reform. Our music is by Bobby Watson and the UMKC Conservatory of Music Concert Jazz Band. We had help today from KCUR's Kathleen Pointer, Danny Alexander, Maria Carter, and Kim Noble. The show is produced by Steven Steigman. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you are up to date.